I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Austin, you wrote a very interesting column this week in your On Point column and your syndicated column that's syndicated across the United States on Charles Martel. Who in the heck is Charles Martel? I think a lot of people ask.
Well, it really wasn't on Charles Martel. It was I was using Charles Martel, Charles a Hammer, as a playing off of the Je suis Charlie Hebdo bumper sticker that arose after the massacre of the French cartoonists and editorialists at the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine. And I got to give credit to, you know, a couple of bloggers that came up with the wisecrack at the time. I saw it on at least two different blogs, and they were using it in a very historically correct manner to say, hey, wait a minute, Western Europeans get to defend ourselves against attacks by Islamist radicals. And Charles Martel won the Battle of Tours early 8th century against a Muslim army that was penetrating southern France. Now, why I chose that, even though that is 250 years, Battle of Tours is 250 years, excuse me, more than that, 350 years before the beginning of the First Crusade. Yeah, you know, you lose a few centuries every once in a while, Dan, when you're having to do this a podcast on the spot. And I, you know, what Jim and I do not work from notes, but President Obama at a national prayer breakfast last week opined that the Crusades and Inquisition were examples of Christian brutality, and he also delved into slavery and Jim Crow segregation, and said that, you know, Christianity was used to justify slavery. And he ignited a storm of criticism, particularly about the Crusades, which I think was very justified. And don't just read what the president wrote. Go look at the video and listen to tone. Listen to the way he says it, which is one of the things I call attention to in my column. He is comparing the Crusades to the Islamic State, ISIL, as we say, Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, which is what Strategy Page uses, and I think that is an accurate way to describe them. But they call themselves now Islamic State. He was comparing the Crusades to the terrorism and depredations of Islamic State, and that's just wrong. In fact, it's historically stupid. And yes, I use that as blunt in that because, look, President Obama and his crowd ran in 2008 touting themselves as on smart diplomacy. They practice, in my view, and I can provide example after example after example after example, and we can start with Syrian red lines if you want. They practice stupid diplomacy. And this is another example of stupid diplomacy. If someone out there in podcast land says there's Austin being partisan, no, I am not being partisan. I think I'm being historically correct, just like the guys were with invoking Charles Martel. There's a real strategic ignorance. And what the president did when he made the comparison between Crusades and Islamic State depredations was give Islamic State and every other Islamist terrorist organization in the region and on the planet a propaganda gift, a propaganda coup is what he did, and here's why. Jim writes about this all the time. I've got essays on this. You can even go back and look at a couple of editions of a Quick and Dirty Guide to War, where I think we have really good two- or three-page summaries on Islamist grievances, embedded grievances, and excuses for cultural and political decline. Now, some of what we're doing, if you really want to read the most in-depth on this, you want to read Bernard Lewis, the great Princeton University Middle Eastern expert, which go back and look at his book from 2001, which I laud, What Went Wrong. It's really focused on the Ottoman Empire. And Lewis is really one of the world's top Ottomanists, and the Turkish scholars recognize that. And those of you who know my background, I'm a big Ataturk guy, and as a result, you have to understand something about the Ottoman Empire since Kemal comes out of the Ottoman army. But Lewis in What Went Wrong discusses very well-informed historical perspective, the excuse-making. And part of the excuse-making is, quote-unquote, the Crusades. Now, I'm moving to this. You won't read this in What Went Wrong, but Lewis also in his lectures refers to a conversation he had with some Middle Eastern Arab Muslims who were telling him they were just going to wait out the Israelis, and the Israelis were just Jewish crusaders, and they were eventually going to leave. And he shook his head, and he said, no, the Turks drove the crusaders out. You didn't. And he's historically right. If you look at the defeats of the final Latin kingdoms, Christian Latin kingdoms, or the of the crusaders, states, Turkish armies and Kurdish armies, and the Kurds would rail at being called Turks, but nevertheless, they weren't Arab, or they weren't substantially Arab. And right there is an example of the historian with the intimate factual understanding undermining the grievance or excuse myth. And to go and say, compare the Crusades to burning a Jordanian pilot alive is it's historically inaccurate to the point of a dangerous absurdity, Dan. And that's where we move into the opinion / analysis of my column. I will admit a quote unquote counter narrative to the Arab grievance narrative that we were just peaceful and here come all these raping Western European knights, you know. And the counter narrative is this, that the Crusades are a belated counterattack. It's far more difficult than that, but there are also aspects where that is true. And let me bring in another strategy page name, Al Nofi. As I was finishing off this column, I gave Al a call. I was going to roughen it out, and I said, "Hey, Al, here's what I'm going to use as a couple of examples of Islamic raids or serious. They're military control of parts, significant parts of southern Italy." And Al kind of chuckled and said, "Well, Austin, you could use this, and this." And I said, "Well, yeah," and I thought about it. I could come up with several hundred, Dan, over a period of four to five centuries. And the examples that I had mentioned to Al was the Muslims took control of the great Italian port city of Toronto. They also controlled Brindisi and Bari. And Al points out, you know, there was a huge battle further up the peninsula in the area of Capua, and Rome was attacked three times. The Vatican was sacked. There were appeals from Christian communities throughout the Levant. Remember, that's the Eastern Mediterranean. and Anatolia, that's the Asia Minor, and southeast of what is now, you know, southeastern Europe for support and help to stop this Muslim onslaught. And I'm also right now leaving out the great flanking movement because Muslims have taken control of Spain. That's where that they were already in the early 8th century. That's where the army that Charles Martel defeated at Tours in southern France was coming across the Pyrenees to attack the Frankish kingdoms. So you've got there's the imperialism that is ignored by the Arab Muslim grievance myth, and they use this contemporary 21st century terrorist, Islamist terrorists, use this as a recruiting tool. And there our president, maybe they'd look at it and say it's small, but no. I noticed the Islamic State was talking about it, a couple of references to it in its propaganda over the past weekend. So Charles Martel is an example of at the time, a rare Western European leader in Christendom who could defeat a Muslim force in open battle. Others arrived, and so the Crusades are there. They are multiple reasons behind the Crusades. Also, remember there were 9 of them too, Dan. That gets lost. So I'll move on. I'd like to hear Jim's response to this. So.
Yeah, I'd sort of like to hear Jim talk about the peaceful spread of Islam during this 7th century.
Well, there are several things to consider here. First of all, is the Crusades initially were called by the Pope for 2 reasons. One, there was increasing Muslim abuse of Christian pilgrims to the holy places in the Jerusalem and the surrounding area. Secondly, the Pope did have other reasons for doing it, and that was mainly some of the the secular lords of Christendom were causing him problems, and somebody came up with the bright idea, why don't we call it a crusade, and promising all sorts of rewards in the hereafter because our coffers are empty, and send them off to the Middle East. And that was indeed one of the primary reasons behind several of the Crusades. But at the same time, the Arabs were still very militant. They were just inept against Christendom, as Charles Martel, proved centuries earlier. The other thing that has to be taken into account, and this is rarely touched upon by Western journalists, is this, how should I put it, different narrative the Arabs have. For example, they believe, and this is, no secret in their media, that it's the West is behind the creation of Al-Qaeda and ISIL, or ISIS. And it's another example of Western attempts to attack Islam. Now, this sounds absurd to Westerners, which is maybe one reason why Western media do not pick up on it. But it's very, very popular, in the Middle East. The other thing which you still see a lot of is Arabs, including educated, Arabs and Muslims in general, will tell you that they don't believe that the 9/11 attacks were carried out by Muslims at all. It was all a CIA plot. Now, you've got some Westerners who buy into that, and we call them kooks. But, in the Arab world and the Muslim world, this is a widespread belief. Again, not just among, the common people who will believe anything, as Bonham put it, but among, fairly educated people. I mean, I've had that discussion with very educated, financial types, on Wall Street. And I finally realized the best thing to do is just to shake my head and go on to another subject, because they understand that they get no traction in the West by spouting that. But if they're asked, they will say it. I'll give them credit for, sticking by their beliefs. But that is totally absurd. There is an Arab reform movement going on, which, again, doesn't touch on this sense of grievance which is a cultural thing more than anything else. I mean, as Austin points out, it's the Turks who have been abusing them for the last five centuries. And of course, they don't want to offend the Turks because the Turks are still there and they're next door. Of course, one thing that complicates the matter is there now is an Islamic party running Turkey for the last decade, which is rapidly wearing out its welcome. And they are agreeing with the Arabs, which many Turks disagree with, because I've never heard a Turk tell me, well, I've heard they're probably out there now, that the 9/11 was not, you know, an attack by Muslims. I mean, to the Turkish mind, the Arabs doing something silly like that is quite in line with their historical experience with the Arabs. I mean, there's an old Turkish saying, which basically translated goes, do not involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs. Our equivalent to that is, don't hit the tar, baby. You know, it's nothing but trouble. And many Turks are upset with their current president, Erdogan, because he is basically involving himself with the affairs of the Arabs, and they know from historical experience and now recent experience that nothing good comes from it. You can see that with ISIL in Syria, with that fiasco in Kobane, the city where they, for a while the Turks were allowing, you know, ISIL people through, but not reinforcements for the Kurds defending this Syrian city against ISIL. We turned them around. Actually, it was turned around largely by internal pressure by many Turks, including, you know, Erdogan's base. He said, oh, my God, he looked at the opinion polls and realized that, you know, most Turks agree with the Westerners that the Arabs, especially ISIL, is nothing but trouble and something must be done. And Austin has written on this frequently, that Turkey is a problem, not just to the Turks, but to their NATO allies. I mean, Turkey is still a member of NATO, and that is problematic. But getting back to what this means for the West is that ISIL is not the disease, it's a symptom of the disease. And the disease is still going to be there, even when ISIL is defeated, and it will be. In fact, I did an update on Iraq today for Strategy Page, and I pointed out that, you know, it's deja vu all over again, this business with the Jordanians. I don't know how many people realize how ironic this is. The woman that the ISIL tried to con the Turks out of into exchanging for at that point, dead Jordanian pilot, which they burned to death on January 3rd, and kept it quiet. They thought that they could con the Jordanians into letting this woman, Sunni Arab suicide bomber, who was arrested in 2005 for taking part in a mass suicide bombing in Jordan. And she was the one whose explosive has failed. She was doing it with her husband. That's another story than that. He told her, as she recounted it, he basically cursed her out and said, well, get out of here. You might get another chance. And then he exploded his and killed 35 people at a wedding reception. The other two bombers also succeeded at social functions and killed over 60 people. This not only turned the Jordanians around, but it all turned the entire Arab world around. As we reported at the time, we reported the results of opinion polls throughout the Arab and the Muslim world and gave the percentages of how the approval, as it were, of al-Qaeda rapidly declined after that. Now, what that event was basically a breaking point. Many Arabs, as we reported, were saying on the street, as it were, where some of my contacts were, that this al-Qaeda, whoever started it, is bad news. They're mainly killing Muslims. Granted, they're killing Shia Muslims, which many Sunni Arabs would agree is not a bad thing. But they were killing, that was resulting in the murder of a lot of Sunni Muslims in revenge by Shia militias. And that's happening all over again. But again, Jordan and the UAE and Saudi Arabia were sort of lukewarm in their support of going after ISIL, even though they knew ISIL was a clear and present danger, as we like to say. ISIL declared that they wanted to basically, you know, throw out the House of Saud and overthrow all the governments in Arabia and form a new caliphate, which, again, you know, most Arabs thought was ridiculous. And Arab scholars were saying, well, this is foolish, blah, 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 issuing fatwas and what have you. But it took a tipping point. And again, the tipping point, 10 years later, occurred in Jordan. And what are the Jordanians doing now? They're unleashing righteous retribution, or the Jordanian equivalent, upon ISIL. And the king, he was in the United States when word came out that the pilot had been already been burned to death, and the video appeared, rushed back to Jordan, and suddenly there were pictures all over the Jordanian media of the king in fatigues, in varying pilot uniforms, what have you. He's a very military type guy, vowing that we're going to get these sons of whatever the Arab equivalent is for that. And they are trying to do just that. It also brought the other Arab states online in a more forceful fashion against ISIL. But again, the thing that gets missed in all this is that this is temporary, because most Arabs still believe that they are under attack by the non-Muslim West, and that their future depends upon, the triumph of Islam. We also point out, both Austin and I in our reporting, that Islam is the only major religion out there now which is militant, which started in militancy, basically, made a lot of its conversions by force. There are very few other major religions which started that way and were so successful that way and that have remained that way. I mean, sure, you can say, 1,000 years ago, the Catholics were, militant, the Protestants were militant and what have you. But I know from my own personal history, I mean, I went to Catholic schools in the 50s and 60s. And back then we used to laugh, our generation, that some of the nuns still believed that only Catholics go to heaven. In other words, they were still following the old line, which is still invoked as being current, which it is not, that the Catholics saw themselves as the only true Christian church. There are probably still a few out there. And that everybody else is, it's like the Sunnis and the Shia. But when was the last time Catholics went around killing Protestants, by the tens of thousands, because they were not, Catholics? That ended, centuries ago. I mean, some of my ancestors fled to New Jersey, of all places, in the 17th century because they were Huguenots, and the religious wars had started up again, when the Edict of Nantes, a previous truce in the religious wars, was revoked. So I can speak from personal experience that what the Arabs are spouting is bull. But our president apparently doesn't get that, and a lot of Americans don't get that. The other problem we have is that it's politics. When Bush decided to go into Iraq, and again, historians, maybe a generation from now, will finally get this straight, as we've been reporting it. Saddam had gone religious in the 90s. He had done a lot of bad things in the 90s. Again, we tend to forget that. And again, we were all there. We were reporting on this. We weren't just there. We were reporting and talking to people inside government. All the intelligence agencies believe that Saddam was up to something bad. And it was also a fact that was reported in the New York Times and others that Saddam had gotten religion. And he was getting very cozy with his Sunni base, because basically the Sunni minority, which had always ruled that area at the behest of the church for several centuries, which, the ISIL and what have you don't like to dwell on. They had this attitude that it wasn't their fault. Nothing that was going wrong was their fault. It's always someone else. And this is the problem that is not going away, even though the Arab Reform Movement is trying. And this is sponsored by Saudi Arabia. Not all Saudis, but members of the royal family have tried to basically form, study groups and start a discussion about the fact that our problems are probably internal. It's not all, the heathens, the non-Muslims and what have you. Maybe the problems are internal. And those who look at it from the outside, which Westerners do, say, look, you got a problem with corruption. You got a problem with not being able to form governments which function efficiently and peaceably and what have you. you're always doing the usual, and this isn't an Arab, it's just an Arab thing, the usual thing that a tyrant will do when they're in trouble, like Putin is doing right now. What do? You look for an external enemy. And for Putin, it's NATO. For the Arabs, it's the West. They can't say the Turks. They'd love to say the Turks. But again, the Turks still scare them. And in fact, as recently as I think it was the 1990s, there was a tiff between Syria and Turkey over the head of the head of the Turkish resistance.
Kurdistan Workers Party, April Ad,
right. Was hiding out in Turkey, and the Turks said, we want them, and if you don't send them, I don't think they finished that sentence. They just mobilized several divisions on the Syrian border, and next thing you know, Öcalan was handed over. And he's been in prison ever since.
Let me just put it. Öcalan was hanging out in the cafe scene in Damascus, Jim. Turkish intelligence had pictures of him out there. And as I recall, and we did write about this, I think the Turks brought a Met Corps up to the border.
Exactly.
Very convincing.
And that was the only message they had to send. No words were needed. You know, Turkish troops on the border of an Arab state is never good. They understood that. And they immediately turned around. And I was, that made an impression on me. He says, God, it's true. because I had one of the guys early on in when I started this wargaming business back in the late 60s, one of the playtesters that showed up was this nuclear physicist who was a Turk. He had just gotten his degree. And he was a very smart guy, obviously a nuclear physicist. And they stayed around for several years. They sent him back to Turkey at one point to do his military service. You know, they were very strict about that. He had avoided going to graduate school and what have you. And even though he was in the United States, they said, hey, come back or else. And he went back and he spent 2 years out in the boondocks teaching, which is what they often did with educated guys who finally got drafted. But he mentioned when he came back, that 2 years later, he was made an interesting offer. They said, look, you don't have to go out and teach, basic literacy to these damn Kurds out in the east, which is where a lot of the illiterate Turks were. He says, we're starting a nuclear weapons program, and you're qualified. And he basically said, look, can I go teach anyway and without repercussions? And I said, okay. But that was interesting that, the Turks were still concerned about the Arabs. And because I later found out that one reason for that nuclear program was they thought Iran under the Shah was getting a little too feisty for their liking, because that was another ancient enemy of the Turks. And they thought they needed nukes. Now, they eventually made a deal with NATO to get nuclear protection like Germany got and what have you. But that didn't satisfy their basic problem with being nervous about the Kurds. But anyway, Oktay, the Turkish guy in question, I asked him, we talk about Turkey and the Ottoman Empire and what have you, and Ataturk and what have you. Very interesting guy. And he's the one who first made me aware of this relationship they always had with the Arabs. A lot of Turks, at least what I hear from his father and his grandfather, that when they lost the empire, especially the Arab part of it, a lot of Turks were quite happy with that. Because one of the worst things that could happen to your son is he goes in the army, gets drafted, and they say, we're going to send you down to occupy, one of the Arab provinces. And they hated that, because I knew they were hated down there, and often they were required to do very ugly things in order to pacify the Arabs, things you can't do anymore. And it worked for 500 years. But they developed this antipathy because the Arabs are just unpredictable, unreliable. It's like the usual, litany of reasons why we don't like these guys. But here now, we're on the receiving end of this. We're dealing with the Arabs. You can do business with them. But as many expats I've spoken to, people who've worked over there and what have you, I mean, Chuck, one of the guys on the FYO site, he worked for many years as a contractor in Saudi Arabia. And him or another guy I knew in a similar position, they were the one that told me about, after 9/11, he found out about it when he heard Arabs whooping to get up and cheering and what have you. And he went to what the hell was going on and went out and one guy sheepishly said, oh, I'm sorry. He stopped laughing and cheering. He said, the World Trade Center was hit by two airplanes. For the Arabs, it was a great victory. Even if it was their patron, as it were, their protector from Iran and Russia and what have you, they just, knee-jerk reaction. And of course, when now it's come out, I don't know if there's anything in this, but there's smoke again about why exactly we quickly and very quietly flew all the senior Arabs in the United States out after 9/11, despite the fact that nobody else could fly. These guys were allowed to fly because there was a reason, which is still apparently classified, why they had to be gotten out. Of course, later, of course, it became clear that 15 of the 19 bombers were from Saudi Arabia. So that sort of raised the red flag. But that's never been answered. How much cooperation there was between the Saudi government and the Al-Qaeda. Of course, what we have learned since is that many wealthy and senior Saudi Arabian, officials support this whole concept of holy war against the infidels, and they finance. And for years, we've had a hard time getting the Saudis to crack down on this because they know they're going to be cracking down on some very influential people, some very influential families, which could cause instability inside Saudi Arabia. And as one great American politician said, pointed out, all politics is local. And for the Saudi king, who is basically herding cats, as I've described it when Saudis explain to me their situation, they laugh at that, although they don't like cats that much, yes, it's still basically a family feud. You've got all these tribes, and the kings and the royal family spend a lot of time just basically keeping the tribes in line, preferably with a carrot. But if that doesn't work, they will hold a stick. And as we've reported in Strategy Page, we recounted how there were times in the past, and actually up until the 70s, when they had to use the stick. And of course, the incident in the 70s was basically the beginning. I like to point out, that others may differ, of the current, outbreak of Arab terrorism, because in that situation, a bunch of radical Saudis tried to overthrow the king, and they did this by invading Mecca and seizing the Kaaba, the most holy of holies in Islam. And much to the chagrin of the Saudi government, they had to do the unthinkable, and they had to order the National Guard, not the regular army, the National Guard, which is the private army of the Saudi family, to protect them from the regular army, if necessary, to go in there and basically conduct a shootout in the Holy of Holies. Now, this is considered a great disgrace, great blasphemy and what have you. But the greater blasphemy was having, basically these radical Muslims, holding it. Despite that, they, again, as is their custom, they made peace with the radicals. And the big mistake they realize it now, but it's kind of too late to undo it, was they gave the Islamic conservatives, who basically preach all this violent jihad, control of the education system. So now you have, two generations of Saudis have come up through this education system, which allows preachers who basically, get up every Friday and give the sermon about how evil the West is, and they're the cause of any problems we have, not the corruption in the House of Saud or within our culture as a whole, but it's all a plot by the Israelis and the West. And that is the disease. And there's very little progress being made in curing that, although there are some attempts, in Saudi Arabia where the cure has to come from, but it's coming very slowly. And they basically don't want to upset the apple cart in their rush to basically find the bad apples and get rid of them. And they're, in a way, they're right, because they do have a problem that this thing has been around for so long, we're talking centuries, that you can't just rip it out constantly, because that, in that case, you'll probably kill the patient in ways that the West will not like. And of course, now you can even hear this if you know local Muslims, especially in the New York area. I've heard more than one guy complain that they get there, it's still very prestigious for a mosque congregation to hire a imam, a cleric, who has been educated in Saudi Arabia or Egypt. But in both cases, well, not so much in Egypt anymore, but in Saudi Arabia, they're still turning out these guys who, when they come to America, usually speaking, at least passable English, they will get up and give that sermon on Friday, and a lot of them will still basically sound like they're basically shilling for Al-Qaeda or ISIL or what have you. Now, they realize that this is anathema, you know, in this country, and they realize that they're offending a lot of their congregation, and in some cases, this has caused violence. For example, here's another prescient example. In 1991, when the first bombing attempt on the World Trade Center was made, I had already been following. I was the Islamic terrorism expert for several TV stations and a network, you know, in the networks in the New York area, which shows how hard up they were for anybody who knew anything about, you know, what was going on inside, you know, Arab culture and Islamic terrorism. And I remember doing one interview, and a guy says, "Look, you got any other leads?" And I said, "Yeah, I do have one, which I just recently heard of. Well, I heard of before the bomb went off." I says, "There was an incident with this congregation, this mosque down in Brooklyn, where somebody was killed as part of a basically a feud within the mosque over a radical, you know, cleric and basically American Muslims who had been here for generations who were not happy with this sort of, you know, radical, you know, crap they were getting." Well, it turned out the guy I didn't know this at the time. It later turned out he was the guy who was sent to prison. He was the blind mullah, as it were, the blind imam, who was basically the guy behind the attacks that I was pontificating about, you know, on the World Trade Center in the 1990s.
The 1993 attack.
93, right. And later on, I said, "Oh, my God." And, of course, I started looking at this more closely. And I keep making inquiries when I run across, you know, a Muslim associate, you know, how are things going at the mosque and what have you. And sometimes they'll say, you know, they'll shove their shoulders and say we should change the subject. But other times they'll say, "Hey, these goddamn sortie, you know, imams, you know, they're maniacs." And it's still leading to, you know, physical violence in some cases. But in most cases, it's just a lot of guys, you know, people just turn away from the mosque. And this doesn't bother the clerics at all. They basically consider anybody who doesn't swallow their line, you know, completely, not to be a real Muslim, and good riddance. And that's what we're still up against in the United, not only in the United States. The Saudis have been exporting these clerics since the 1970s. They're all over the world. You go to any country which has been on the receiving end, and most have, they have any Muslim population at all, the Saudis will come in and say, "Hey, look, we'll give you $1 million to build a classy new mosque. We'll do this. We'll send missionaries and what have you." And, you know, it reminds me of the old, quip about, you know, once the camel gets its nose inside the tent, you know, more camel will follow. They regret it. And you look at any area, any non-Arab Muslim state, or where there's a Muslim minority, and there's Islamic radicalism, you can trace it back to these Saudi-financed missionary efforts. This is the disease which nobody wants to pay much attention to.
Dan, let me make a comment about that. You know, I've written about this several times in material. It shows up on the strategy page, but there's also an article I did for a weekly standard in sometime, I think published sometime in 2003, called Straitsjacket. It was about the Straits of Malacca, and I'd been to Singapore. And Jim knows about this in great detail. I ran into a number of Malaysians who constantly expressed not just worry, but disgust with what they would call Arab Islam, and what they're referring to is Saudi Arabian clerics or sponsored clerics with money coming in and specifically starting Quranic kindergartens. And that's what he says, we can't compete with their money. And this was a Malaysian scholar and a Muslim, a Sunni Muslim himself. He says, you know, our Southeast Asian brand of Islam, Dar Bay, it's not like theirs. And of course, I'm quite aware of that. One other comment, and I know Jim and I sometimes delve into anecdotes on strategy talk, which I hope entertains and informs our audience. But just pick up on something that Jim said about the Quranic education here in the United States. I'm going to mask this because I know this couple pretty well. The fact is, the man I know very well, and they're both Muslims, and they about 5 years ago, he told me about looking for a school in the city they live in Texas. It's not my city, but in the they did, where they wanted to expose their children to get a good exposure to the Quran and Arabic, and they were very, very careful about it, because he says, Jim is going to laugh at this. Even in Texas, you have some of these guys show up, Austin. I said, yeah, I can believe that. And they did. They did find such a place, and there are plenty of them. And that's, as Jim says, you know, they're Muslims that have been in the United States for, you know, generations, and they just don't. It's just not the same kind of militant spiel by any sense. One other comment too. Jim talked about the seizure of the of Mecca and the fight with the Saudi National Guard. Jim, didn't the French ultimately give the Saudis use of a commando company in that? I mean, it was even more of a embarrassment that they had to go and bring in some, you know, boys from Western Europe to help with the Mahdi's attack. I believe that's correct. So
I forget the details, and I'm sure the Saudis went to great lengths to scrub that particular aspect of it from the historical record as much as they could. They've also learned to use their money for lobbying in the United States, for basically information wars, we call it. They've been very adroit in basically placating their own Islamic radicals by basically trying to throw them these little bones, and it's all backfired. And a lot of Saudis are now saying, you know, maybe we should rethink this, but it's very difficult.
Dan, I'm looking at the time, and I was wind it up, but look, to bring back to Charles Martel, you know, Jim gave you a very detailed discussion of current extremist Islamist, you know what, it's propaganda. I was going to say education, but propaganda. But crusades, their imperialist Christian crusades narrative plays a role in that. And that was the spur behind my column. As for their own, you know, Muslim army's battlefield successes in the 7th century and 8th century, what they say is Allah wanted us to win. See, there's the flip to that. And, you know, if they even acknowledge Charles Martel, that he's defending France or the Frankish kingdoms, it's with a shrug, you know. Well, you know, we'll be back because Allah wants us to win. So you're left with, okay, if that's the way you see it, Charles Martel's going to fight you back. And that was why I found that line, Je suis Charles Martel, so funny in light of the Je suis Charlie Hebdo bumper sticker. Okay.
At some point, we're going to have to talk further about one of the things that you brought up in your article, but you didn't really get into, and that's 21st century slave trade.
Oh, I'll be glad.
Oh, yes.
I've written a lot about that over the last 20 years. Let's call it quits, guys. We're coming. This is a long one. All right.
And we'll talk to you guys later. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye bye.